And I'm Phil Latzman. Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN, our weekly mission to keep South Florida informed on local, regional, state news and issues affecting our community with a panel of the area's top journalists. And this week they are as follows. We have a couple of newbies. Teresa Frontado is senior editor for online and production at Nel Nuevo Herald. She's an office mate as we do the newscasts at WLRN from the Herald newsroom. Teresa, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Phil. Thank you for having me today.
Rosemary Goudreau traveled a little bit further. She comes from Broward County, where she is the Sun Sentinel's editorial page editor and also co-founder of Florida Voices, the state opinion page. Rosemary, welcome to you.
Happy to be here.
And an old salt on the radio airwaves is Mark Caputo, who is the Miami Herald's lead political writer. Welcome back to you, Mark.
Thanks.
And for Mark, by the way, as we prepare for our town hall, I must get this off our chest. Now, we our plea to just right there in Fort Lauderdale, right near the Sun Sentinel headquarters, we're going to be doing our town hall meeting on February 25th in advance of the state legislative session. We're basically asking you, if you care about what goes on in Tallahassee, we know you do. If you do, we have a pair of state legislators, at least two. They're going to be there, and the Miami Herald's Tallahassee bureau chief, and just a group of hundreds of other people that are interested in what goes on in the state. So this is what we call civic engagement by your public radio station, Monday, February 25th at 6:30 p.m. when we start the taping. There's a preamble and some extra stuff they'll be doing beforehand. But we'd love you to RSVP for this at our website, WLRN.org. Now, Mark, you are now the lead political writer for the Miami Herald, but you spent many years in Tallahassee covering the state. So what do you think the top issues will be facing lawmakers as we enter session?
Well, there's the top issues that they should deal with, and then there's what they deal with. Right now, they're talking ethics reform, which I think everyone agrees is probably a good idea. There's also the question of what took you guys so long. We've had a lot of ethical scandals in the state. Voting issues should be important as well. A few years ago, the Republican legislature scaled back early voting, and we had some real problems this last election as a result. So presumably, they're going to reverse themselves and return it to the way it was, hopefully not to deal with the long lines, but we'll see. One of the big issues that really affects a lot of people in South Florida is property insurance. I'm not sure that's going to be something that the legislature will take up to the benefit of consumers. They seldom do. The past few pieces of legislation that they filed have helped your rates go up. The insurance industry says your citizens' property insurance rates need to go up, but we're learning in some testimony that Citizens is actually doing quite well for itself, thank you very much, and a lot of private operators now want a piece of that semi-public money to get in the game, and your rates will probably rise. So if you're going to go to this WLRN event on Monday, you might want to ask Senator Chris Smith and Senator Jack Latvala about it.
Yeah, and that is something that happens in Tallahassee that doesn't necessarily affect people directly in Tallahassee, being in the rural northern region, that affects us directly here in South Florida. And that sort of leads me to the question about the disconnect about what happens in Tallahassee and how it affects South Florida, and the fact that there's 500 miles between us, and it almost seems like longer and just another world.
Well, understand that the legislature is a place where special interests go to fight each other and get a piece of their turf. I was just talking a moment ago with someone about this. Like, for instance, the optometrists and the ophthalmologists battle each other every year, and they're doing it this year again, to see who can put things like medicinal eye drops in your eyes. This isn't something that the average person really worries about, but you'll have the telecom companies fighting each other, the cable companies, all these various special interests, and the legislature essentially referees them. The real point for a legislative session is to pass a budget that runs the entire state. It's going to be about $74 billion. That occupies a good amount of the 60-day lawmaking session that begins in March.
And we're going to be talking about that. Of course, we want you to RSVP because of these very reasons of what happens in Tallahassee affects your life. So go to the website, come to our town hall meeting Monday, February 25th at WLRN.org. So let's move on. We're going to talk more about state stuff in a little bit. Let's move to the State of the Union address and hit home here in many ways, none more than when President Obama included a reference to Florida's voting debacle. There was an acknowledgement of the struggle to vote for a local centenarian. President Obama looked to the crowd where North Miami's Desalene Victor was seated in the First Lady's box.
When Desalene arrived at her polling place, she was told the wait to vote might be 6 hours. And as time ticked by, her concern was not with her tired body or aching feet, but whether folks like her would get to have their say. And hour after hour, a throng of people stayed in line to support her. Because Desalene is 102 years old. And they erupted in cheers when she finally put on a sticker that read, "I voted."
And was everybody standing up, Desalene Victor in the crowd, a charming lady, 102 years old. Do you think that, Rosemary, that was the first thing that resonated here, was those voting problems and seeing people like Desalene waiting online for so many hours in November?
Well, clearly there was a lot of passion and energy about the debacle that happened last November. But I personally was disappointed that the president took so much time talking about this, because in Tallahassee, the message has been heard. Yes, they're the ones who were responsible for making the mess by shortening the number of days that we had to vote, by reducing the number of hours. But message has been heard loud and clear. Action is happening in Tallahassee. The legislation is moving. Even the governor, who didn't allow an extension of early voting hours in November, even he agrees it needs to happen. So of all of the things that we need Washington to focus on right now, while this is important, it's a state issue, and action's happening in the state, and there's other things that I'd like to see the president focus on.
Good point. And Teresa Frontato, what did you hear that resonated here in South Florida from the president on Tuesday night?
Well, the voting debacle resonated, but there was also a lot of discussion about the immigration reform and the announcement that he made, for action,
right,
to Congress, asking to establish a pathway to citizenship and saying let's do this. I think of particular interest here in South Florida is the announcement that he made that he wants to streamline the immigration process for families, workers and businesses, because there's a lot of people here in South Florida that are already here and want to bring their families from abroad, and they would be benefited by a streamlining of this process.
You're one of the people who came here legally, came here to go to school, went through all the whole process of becoming a citizen, a dual citizenship, I guess. Yes. You're Venezuelan. So, I mean, now you hear about this amnesty for 11 million people who may not have done what you did. How does that, I mean, just if you're covering this, when you hear these things in the State of the Union, how do you feel about them?
Well, I understand the reasons for and against it, I think it is at this point a necessity that the government needs to deal with these people that are already in our country, and it has to be done in a fair way, in a way that respects the people like me or some other people that came here legally and had to wait and jump through hoops and pay mm-hmm. lawyers' fees. But it is true that we have close to 11 million people here, and we need to find a way to know who they are, incorporated as taxpayers, and legalize their situation here.
Over 800,000 of them in Florida. And Mark, on gun control, that was a big theme. We saw Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, DNC chair, with a victim of a drive-by shooting from Hialeah named Megan Hobson as her guest. We had the freshman congresswoman from Boca Raton, Lois Frankel, the mother of one of the Newtown school shooting victims. And we heard a lot about gun control, but the feeling here is that not much will change in Florida on that.
Oh, certainly not. I don't think you're going to see any changes from the Florida legislature. It is an open question what's going to happen in Congress. If you look at the polling, 90% of people or so, and this is more than just one poll, support the idea of a universal background check. Wayne LaPierre with the NRA used to support a universal background check. It'd be interesting to see if it's just that issue, if it can pass this Congress or not.
And Rosemary Goudreau, there was a mention from the president of, quote, "we must act on climate change." And as we've seen in Fort Lauderdale with the A1A being obliterated by high tides, we can all kind of see this now. Was enough addressed on climate change in the State of the Union that hits us right at home?
Well, it's good to hear the president talking about it, and he needs to talk a lot more about it. I would also point out that in Tallahassee this week, South Florida's legislative delegation got together to talk about it. Half of our 50 lawmakers showed up. Half, it should have been all of them, but because South Florida is particularly threatened with our low elevation and the rising sea level. And yes, the road in Fort Lauderdale is going to be reduced, the number of lanes in Delray Beach. The beaches need renourishing. Across our Key West has seen 9-inch increase in sea level over the last 100 years. People at the local level get it. People in Tallahassee are starting to get it. But at a national level, more needs to be done. And Marco Rubio was wrong last week when he said that, well, so long as China and India aren't doing anything about carbon emissions, why should we? Let us be the future that we need to be. And that wasn't a leader-like statement on his part.
What a great transition. We're going to talk about Marco Rubio in just a moment. Want to tell people they're listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. It's Rosemary Goudreau from the South Florida Sun Sentinel. She edits the editorial page there. Teresa Frontado from El Nuevo Herald also with us, and Mark Caputo from the Miami Herald. And you are welcome to join us. We have a tweet-a-thon going on. I don't know what you want to call this. It's an online discussion through Twitter, I guess, which is taking place at WLRN with our social media editor. It's also going on Facebook. We do have a Facebook page. It's a live blog. It's an online discussion, basically so we can continue the discussion after we get off the air. And we'd love to hear from you through that. And later on, we'll be talking about the idea of Spanish as a second language in South Florida and whether we should be a bilingual community. So we've got that coming up. But as long as we're on the topic of Marco Rubio, billed as the Republican savior on the cover of this week's Time magazine and an historic GOP response following President Obama's speech, Florida's junior senator from Miami delivered the rebuttal in both English and, for the first time, in Spanish.
Y como lo escucharon esta noche, su solución a casi todos los problemas es darle al gobierno más dinero para gastar.
So, en español and in English, Marco Rubio said the problem the president has to nearly every solution to every problem is to give the government more waste or money to waste. Teresa, what did you hear from Marco Rubio's speech, and how different was it for those who don't speak fluent Spanish or at all in some cases from what he said in English?
No, it was very similar. His Spanish is very good. I mean, and it was he's a hometown boy, so people. Most of the people were excited and happy, and they commented, oh, it's been almost the year of the Cubans, in the sense that we have the poet, and we have the
Richard
priest.
Blanco.
Yes,
yeah.
Richard Blanco, and the priest do the blessing at the end of the
inaugural address.
Yes.
The other one. Yeah.
So there was a lot of that, and a lot of comment about the delivery of the speech.
He did seem a bit nervous, and obviously that moves on to the next. And we'll skip over next to Paul to the next. Let's hear his the impromptu moment, which we all saw, kind of being described. He reached off camera to get the water bottle. He wiped away sweat a few times, and then the next morning on CBS, he talked about the now infamous water bottle moment.
But, you know, when you talk a lot, it happens. Unfortunately, when you're giving a speech, you have a podium and the water's there. When you're standing up in front of a camera, you don't have that option. It had been a long day of work. I had already taped an 18-minute speech in Spanish, so I'm just glad the water was nearby. I don't know what I would have done without it.
And that prompted Comedy Central's Stephen Colbert to parody the moment.
Don't worry, Senator Rubio. Nobody noticed that you gave a speech. Now, folks...
All right, so, Mark, is this the Bobby Jindal moment? The Louisiana governor gave a speech, a Republican response a few years ago, and was criticized. Is not ready for national stage, Marco Rubio?
Bobby Jindal's speech was consistently weird for the entire spot, the entire time. Rubio's speech was just very weird for the water-sipping moment. But he's got to stop unforced errors. If the sip becomes a slip. You slip, you get hit. This is the political game.
Well, there should have been an aide there to make sure that didn't happen.
He should know.
And he taped the Republican response. Wouldn't he have taped? They know in advance what's going to happen, the speech, so they could have taped that, too.
Well, that's a good question. He should know. And if he wants people to actually listen to what he says, he cannot afford to continue to do those sorts of things. Now, MSNBC has certainly led the way on this, pointing out that, okay, beyond the weirdness of the speech, here are all the logical inconsistencies in his speech, and they do have some points. Rubio talks about how effective Medicare has been for his family. Now he wants to change it. He got student loans, which the federal government backs. Now he's not as supportive of student loans. These are issues on substance that these questions are going to continue to come up. And when he stops making these strange errors, and he's made them in the past with his finances and embarrassed himself in that way, he's going to have to answer these questions, especially in this current media world where the presidential race for 2016 is on now.
Right.
He's putting himself in position now to do it. And the vetting is happening now. So if he wants to have a better say in that vetting, he's going to have to not have unforced errors.
All right. Quickly, Rosemary, get the last word on this Marco Rubio incident. Is it true? Will everybody always remember the water bottle and not the speech?
He was a deer in the headlights for that moment, and people will remember it. But his recovery was good.
Agreed.
The next day,
yeah.
You know,
right,
he took that moment
water bottles
and he
through his
owned
pack.
It. Yeah. Yeah, so he embraced the moment and shared in the laugh. My disappointment with his speech was that he was not the new face of the Republican Party. If he is going to create a more inclusive party, and he went back to the same old talking points. He did sound like Mitt Romney. So that's, to me, where he dropped the water bottle.
All right. It's Rosemary Goudreau from the South Florida Sun Sentinel.
He was metaphors, carrying Romney's water.
Metaphors, metaphors. Mark Caputo from the Miami Herald and Teresa Frontato from El Nuevo Herald. I'm Phil Latzman. We got many other things to discuss, and we'll do that when we continue in just a moment. And I'm Phil Latzman. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Where your questions are welcome, and we'll be taking them. You can always email us at thefloridaroundup@gmail.com. You can also tweet us at WLRN. I'm at Phil Latzman. I know everybody on the panel has their own Twitter address. Teresa, what's yours?
At T Frontado.
Mark, your Twitter handle?
I'm sorry, I was looking at Twitter.
Sound like my wife. Yeah.
It's at Mark A. Caputo.
And Rosemary.
And I'm at Rosemary Goodrow.
Goodrow. And I think people in our audience probably figure out how to spell that. So we also have our blog going on through Twitter. We believe in Twitter. We love Twitter. And also on our Facebook page, which is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. And, of course, our website where we'll post the show after it's completed for those who may have missed it live. It's at WLRN.org. So I had to move on to the – and this is talk about overcoverage. Twitter was lighting up with this last night, the Carnival cruise ship problems. Whatever you think of the coverage, the ship, the Triumph, did arrive after five miserable days at sea in the Gulf of Mexico last night. Thousands of passengers on board, and maybe too much was made of all this, but Carnival Corporation is a Miami-based company. The cruise ship industry is very important to the economy here. Is this likely to be felt adversely here in South Florida, Rosemary? And in fact, the whole state's got ports and cruises all over the place.
When something goes wrong with a cruise ship, it is such a big visual moment. You know, who can forget that ship overturned in the Mediterranean, and now this one, you know, being dragged across the Gulf, and then the tug line breaks, and oh, the stories and the tweets about the overflowing bathrooms. But that and it wasn't a good moment when the owner of the company went and enjoyed himself at a Heat game.
Mickey Arison.
But I think that the cruise industry remains something that, you know, we embrace. It's an important part of our economy, and most people who've been on a cruise had a great time, so it will survive. They seem to be doing a good job in their PR. They're giving the money back. They're giving them $500. They're giving them another cruise. They did what they could do, so I think cruises will continue to be a popular way to spend a vacation.
And Carnival stock, by the way, only down a little bit. Last when I looked this morning, it was down like 11 cents, which is not a ton. The other thing that has been making rounds in South Florida, which is peripheral, not necessarily directly impacting us, but pretty much with the 10,000 American Airlines employees here in South Florida, this merger bringing, as Miami International Airport director, I think Jose Abreu, said, the move bringing stability to one of Miami-Dade County's largest employers more than a year after the airline and its parent company filed for bankruptcy protection. Actually, this is just a quote here, but what does this mean here? I mean, is this a big deal, Teresa Frontato, this merger between American and U.S. Airways?
We've seen a lot of questions and emails and tweets from our readers, especially readers in South America.
Right.
Because this is a big hub for them. I mean, when they're coming to the U.S., they usually stop in Miami and they continue their trip. So there's a lot of uncertainty as what is going to happen. We got a couple of emails and even phone calls saying, hey, I have a trip scheduled for next month. Do you know what's going to happen? So usually the announcement has been taken with with good, I mean, good spirit, but there's also the uncertainty as to what is going to happen. How is it going to affect the day-to-day travelers?
Hannah Sampson, by the way, has been doing some great reporting on all that for the Miami Herald. She has a story today, but basically she's telling us that, Americans already pared down a lot. They're not going to make too many more changes as far as, you know, getting rid of people, so that part as far as the jobs. And then she says the frequent flyer miles will eventually merge and you can use them, you know, for both airlines if you have U.S. Airways. So who knows what's going to come with that? Doesn't sound like it'll be a huge deal. Moving on, and we're going to talk education, in fact, in just a moment. But before we do that, ethics. And this is something you talked about at the top, Mark Caputo. But this week, that in front and center and on display in Orlando at the criminal trial of former Republican Party of Florida Chair Jim Greer, had promised to be an embarrassing affair for some party leaders, including Marco Rubio, a former Governor Charlie Crist, who's contemplating his future now as a Democrat. He did plead guilty, Jim Greer, this week to using his position as party chair to steer business to his fundraising company. Not a good thing. But this did not go to trial. This ended up in a plea. What might have we heard, Mark, if this had gone to trial?
I don't think we would have heard much more. Jim Greer's lawyer billed this as a story like a Shakespearean tragedy where everyone dies in the end. To use a literary metaphor, his client was more like Tartuffe, the buffoon in the Molière play. He looked like a goof. He fought this all the way. He probably paid Damon Chase's lawyer quite a bit of money, and he pleaded guilty in the end because he was guilty.
But why on the eve of that? I mean, wouldn't they have been able to come with a plea deal a long time ago?
I think they had done a pretty good job saying, look, these charges won't stick. These charges won't stand. He didn't steal the money. And it was unclear as to whether he did or not when you looked at the facts that were there. But the state obviously was confident of its case. One of the questions that the case would have revolved around is whether Charlie Crist, then the governor, knew that Jim Greer was getting money from his contract, this secret contract that the rest of the party didn't know about. Crist said he didn't know that Greer was getting the money, making it therefore a theft. But Brian Ballard, a lobbyist, former friend and supporter of Crist, said that Crist did know. Hmm. If anything could start to blow up on any political candidate,
right,
current, future, or past, it would be Charlie
and
Crist.
And he was the guy that chose him to be the party chair, so it would have blown up in his face more than anybody else. Rosemary?
That said, what the Jim Greer case exposed was how the business of politics works. And that is that parties are able to command six and seven-figure checks from companies that go to provide living expenses for people and $600 a night motel rooms and lavish dinners and paying for flooring for Marco Rubio or a string of dinners for former House Speaker Dean Cannon. Obviously, Jim Greer was guilty of taking advantage of the money that was flowing into the party. But as Florida talks about ethics reform, and we're focused on these committees that lawmakers put
right
together,
CCEs,
we need to look at the money that are going into the political parties that are controlled by the leadership and used to decide who wins in the primaries, who's losers, and just the incredible millions of dollars that get laundered through these parties.
And this is the same day that the House passes an ethics bill, at least a committee passes an ethics bill, which would get rid of these committees of continuous existence, CCEs, right? Hard to track, and they can funnel money to campaign attacks. In exchange, they would allow donors to write checks of as much as $10,000, up from $500, but we'd know who they were. Is that correct, Mark?
Yeah, but this goes back to what we talked about originally when we opened the show, is the legislature is a place with a special interest business open sign on its front door. It does the business of special interests. The Republican Party of Florida, Republicans control the legislature. So Bell South or a big one, the Blue Cross Blue Shield, sugar, every big major special interest pumps money into the political parties. They give some to the Democrats too, just in case, as like insurance. They give hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, and in the end, long run, they hope they get tens of millions of dollars in return. I'm not sure, though, what you can do to change that, because money is defined as speech, largely, by the U.S. Supreme Court, so this is the system we're going to have. It does help, though, if it is all transparent and obvious, and the Republican Party of Florida scandal, one of the big problems with these credit cards, where people really didn't see the fact that various lawmakers were ringing up various expenses that look highly questionable. Just so you know, Rubio does dispute the flooring thing. It appears he did ring it up, but then claims he reimbursed the party. The question is, when did he reimburse the party for the tiles he had in his house?
You know, Rosemary, I wanted to mention, and I don't know if we're going to have time to hear from the two lawmakers, but maybe we will. We have an education segment coming up in just a moment. But you know what? Let's hear, because you mentioned before about the sea level rise, and there was a conference Wednesday talking about state lawmakers. So let's hear Monroe County Administrator Roman Gestesi, who said the waters off Key West, as you mentioned, have gone up 9 inches in the last 100 years, and the rise is accelerating.
What we're looking at now is 9 to 24 inches in the next 50 years, 9 to 24. So it's a big range, 3 to 7 in 20 years.
Here's Democratic West Palm Beach Representative Mark Pafford, who says tourism and property values in Southeast Florida will be impacted soon if communities don't move quickly.
The beaches are gone. You've got palm trees that are actually dying of salt water. These are negative changes that we're now living through, and it requires immediate action.
So, Rosemary, we hear about seawalls and restoring the Everglades and all these mitigation things, but what is immediate action? What could we do?
Well, it starts at a national level. It is a global problem, and we need to first stop more harm from happening. And that's why Congress needs to do something about carbon emissions, which it's been sitting on its hands. At a state level, help people of Florida be heard on this. I think we ought to have a constitutional amendment that says Florida wants action on climate change, darn it. Just like we had a constitutional amendment last year about Obamacare, which we happened to favor, let's do one on climate change. In the meantime, we got to get serious about coastal development, about moving our well fields into places that are protected so that our water supply is protected. We've got to pay attention to our beaches and re-nourishing our beaches so that our tourism doesn't suffer. But we need leadership at a national level. And if Tallahassee did more to help our voices be heard, and if our delegation helped our voices be heard, maybe Congress would listen.
We hope that may be a topic that you could bring up at our town hall meeting February 25th at the Broward Center next Monday. Another plug there for our exercise in civic engagement. We hope you do come. You can RSVP at WLRN.org. Another big thing we're going to be talking about is education. And we're going to turn to our State Impact Florida reporter, Sarah Gonzalez. This is her last show with us. She's actually moving to New York next week. But before she leaves, she is working on a story on school arrests. Sarah, welcome. Good to talk to you again for the final time.
Thanks, Phil.
So you're telling us that close to 14,000 students were arrested in Florida schools. What are these students being arrested for?
Well, close to 70% of those students who are being arrested for misdemeanor offenses. So that can include a minor school fight, but it can also include anything that falls under disorderly conduct, which can be bad behavior, things like talking back to a teacher or being disrespectful, things that some people say are just normal childlike behavior. And 65% of those cases were thrown out. They were either dismissed or diverted, which means students had to, let's say, write an apology letter to a school or maybe pay a fine for something that they may have damaged. So students were being arrested, but they were never being charged with anything because apparently the behavior was not so bad that it warranted any kind of criminal action by the state attorney.
Right.
Another way to look at it is that, those students were being arrested for things that they likely would not have been arrested for if whatever happened outside of a school.
So this is a story you're going to hear Monday morning on WLRN. And I understand that even, quickly, some of these cases are dismissed. The arrest stays on these kids' records, right? And they're very young.
Right. Technically, juvenile records are supposed to be kept private, but public record laws in Florida allow the Department of Law Enforcement to sell arrest data to companies that run background checks for employers, for example. And so it follows these juveniles for the rest of their life.
And you're going to be talking about town hall issues related to education. You're hosting an online chat next week. In fact, I think it's Tuesday at 4 p.m. You can join that chat on WLRN.org. Teachers, students, professors, concerned citizens. It's going to be a major issue over funding in Tallahassee. You'll be in New York. We're moving to New York to cover for WNYC. What have you learned in your 2 years covering education issues here in Florida?
There's so much to talk about. I'm really sad to leave, and someone else will take over. So WLRN will still be getting their dose of education coverage.
Sarah Gonzalez with our State Impact Florida team. Hey, good luck in New York. It's our official goodbye, I guess, to you on the air.
Thanks, Bill.
All right. And one other thing before we hit the break here. I think that we all remember that the situation with Relia Wilson and this case that came up many years ago, the disappearance of this 4-year-old girl. This week, sort of the conclusion to all that is Geralyn Graham was given 55 years in prison, essentially a life sentence for this woman. Her body's never been found. This girl's disappearance led to all kinds of things at the Department of Children and Families. Several high-level positions discovered that caseworkers were falsifying reports, and that kind of flipped Jeb Bush's world around back then as governor of the state, Mark, as you well remember. But we still hear about all these other problems with DCF. The Palm Beach a newborn who died under questionable circumstances this week that may have been avoided if DCF had been on top of that. The Dontrell Melvin, who went missing over a year, starting in July of 2011. No one was looking for him until a few weeks ago. And then the Nubia Barahona case, where the DCF worker visited the home, reported that her and her twin brother were safe. These are things that constantly we're continuing to see these things come out. So DCF really hasn't fixed its wagon, Teresa.
I mean, Rosemary was saying that Florida residents should stand up and protest against what's going on with the beaches. I think we should stand up and really protest what's going on with DCF. When I read the report about what happened to Dentrell, I didn't know if I wanted to scream or cry. Cry as a mother, scream as a journalist. It's unbelievable that we're still dealing with the same issues with DCF, that these things keep on popping up, failure to follow through, or just dismissal of what seemed to be, and again, hindsight is 2020, but what seems to be clear signs,
right,
of abuse or clear warning signs are just being missed left and right. So we should, as citizens, really stand up and say enough is enough. It's been a series of horrifying death, and I don't see any signs that all these reports that were done. I mean, with the Barahona case, they had an extensive 14 pages report about what happened and what could be improved, and we're still dealing with the same situation. So we need to take a stand.
Mark, politically, how difficult is that, dealing with the DCF on a government level there?
When I was a kid in Florida, it was called HRS, and it was, they had horror stories then, and it became DCF, and it had horror stories. And then there were horror stories before Relia Wilson, and then after Relia Wilson, there were horror stories, and there will continue to be. I think in the end, we are imperfect creatures, and if people are going to lie, if people aren't going to care, and if people aren't going to say to their bosses and people up the chain, look, damn it, if you don't do something, this child is going to die. And if those people don't go public and risk their jobs, which they shouldn't have to do, this will continue to happen. And I'm not saying that even if these folks do go public, that it won't happen again. But in the end, this relies on people doing the right thing. We can pump money into the system and maybe pay people better and get a better quality of person. I'm not sure. But evil exists, and innocent children suffer. They have in the past. It's happening probably right now. There will be another dead child. There will be more dead children. There will be more legislation with the names of a dead child on it. And it's going to happen next year, a few years. It's going to happen over and over again.
And I guess we just wonder why this seems to happen in South Florida, where, by the way, almost half of South Florida's children are growing up in or near poverty. That's a new study that also came out this week. So not good news for kids in South Florida.
It started to be depressing. But
yeah.
It's always been that way.
We're going to cheer things up. Well, we're going to talk about some other stuff. In fact, we did promise that we're going to talk about bilingualism in South Florida, and we're going to talk about that when we get back, and also maybe get a little local reaction to the announcement from the Vatican on the resignation of the Pope. So stay with us. Some more local issues on tap. The Florida Roundup continues in just a moment. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman. Of course, that news from many thousands of miles away this week in the Vatican felt here in South Florida. 1.3 million Catholics live in Miami-Dade and Broward alone, about 2.3 million overall in the state. That's according to the Miami Archdiocese. Father Ferry Brutus has been a priest for 2 years at St. Kevin Catholic Church in Miami. He says that people should be grateful for Pope Benedict XVI's resignation.
It is a humble thing. It is something that we have to appreciate because he was in a position of power where he could have stayed there and until he died because no one could ask him to step down.
And Sarah Gonzalez, this is a different Sarah Gonzalez, goes to St. Augustine Catholic Church in Coral Gables for daily mass. She says she supports the Pope's decision.
I was surprised when I first heard it, and then I felt peace. I believe he's guided by the Holy Spirit, and I think if he doesn't feel he can lead the church anymore, I think he's doing the right thing.
And the top Catholic in South Florida is Miami Archbishop Thomas Wenske, who says the 85-year-old Benedict's departure may end up being his greatest legacy.
In early March, we will have a new pope, see him perform the Holy Week services, and keep the appointment that Benedict made to Rio de Janeiro for World Youth Day in July.
So his legacy, and now the one thing that I keep thinking about is, you know, the College of Cardinals meets, so much growth in Latin America, you know, obviously so many Catholics coming from Latin America. Teresa, you think there's a chance that we could have a Latin American pope?
Well, there's always hope. it's very hard to predict who's going to win. Who's going to be elected?
Who's going to be elected by the? I wonder if it's on intrigue.
No, it's still winning.
Is it on intrigue?
It's always a dark horse. If we wanted to be fair, I think it should be somebody from the third world, from South America or from Africa. But I heard also a lot of analysts saying that Italy wants a pope too. So, I mean, it's
they've had
arms.
Some before, though, right?
I know, so, you know, they should share.
But Rosemary, what do you think in South Florida? How does this reverberate here?
I remember years ago, I worked at the Miami Herald then, and Pope John Paul came to Miami, and this the outpouring of love for that pope. I don't know that Pope Benedict had quite that emotional connection with people, that he was more a caretaker pope or a transitional pope. And the questions that I first asked myself when I heard it was not, wow, gosh, he's retiring and how unprecedented is that, but where will the next one come from? And given the stain that the church has suffered in the United States with the priest abuse scandal, and yes, it's not limited to the United States, but because of the horrible horror that's been inflicted on children, I hope that the next pope does not come from the United States.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup. That's Rosemary Goudreau from the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Also with us, Teresa Frontaro from El Nuevo Herald and Mark Caputo from the Miami Herald. Teresa, you wanted to talk about, we've done a lot of reporting on the show about the Venezuelan nationals here in South Florida. You've talked about on the air on our morning edition programs your experience in voting in the election in New Orleans and having to go there. And you've experienced it and reported on it at the same time. First of all, just what's going on? We haven't heard from Hugo Chavez. He's still
in Cuba. We did this morning.
Oh, we
just
don't know.
Right,
wow,
before.
Breaking news.
Yes, there were two pictures that were tweeted today by members of the Venezuelan government that showed Chavez with his daughters reading a grama
in Cuba.
The Cuban newspaper. He's laying down.
It's
and
advertising.
You can say so, yes. It looks like almost like a proof of life, almost, right, you know, right, with a paper right of the day. But he's laying down. He has a tracheotomy. He's kind of trying to smile, but it looks more like a grind. But it's the first time since December 11th that there's any picture of the Venezuelan president.
So not on his deathbed, it doesn't look like. It was hard to tell.
Yes,
picture.
I mean.
What about now, as this is going on, as his absence from Venezuela, we're hearing about the currency devaluation and something you've been reporting and looking at as not only a reporter, but as a citizen. What's going on?
Yeah, the morning that the Pope announced his resignation, my mother called and she was in crisis and she said, first we were devalued and now we're being beheaded. And I was like, Mom, what are you talking about? And she was talking about the fact that there was a devaluation of the currency in Venezuela that was announced last week in the midst of Carnival. So people were really taken by surprise. Hmm. Although they knew it was going to happen. It was the way it was done took people by surprise. And then, you know, with the Pope's resignation, she felt that she has lost her head. But yeah. it was something that was expected. It was something that the IMF and other economic organizations were saying that should have happened before, but it still is significant. It's a 32% devaluation. The official exchange rate for the dollar went from 4.30 to 6.30. Let me remind you that there's been an exchange control in Venezuela for a decade.
Right. How could that affect us, though, the devaluation in South Florida?
Yes,
obviously there's a lot of
expats. A lot. Well, in several ways, because there's a lot of businesses, local businesses that bring goods and take goods to Venezuela. And it's not clear. I mean, the government used to have a special rate of dollars for importers and medium and small businesses, and that has been taken off. And that is not clear how the new system is going to work. So it's going to hurt. It's also going to hurt some other countries in the region, like Colombia or Brazil or even Cuba, that have trade with Venezuela. And even American companies like Halliburton announced that it's going to have $30 million less in earnings because of the devaluation in Venezuela.
Very interesting. You know, Doral, as I interviewed earlier this year, the first Venezuelan-born mayor in South Florida, Luigi Borja. And this week, there was a proposal, I think, sponsored by the mayor, supported by the mayor, in Doral, which has the highest population of Venezuelan, or percentage, I guess you could say, of Venezuelan Americans, of Venezuelan descent in the country, really. He made this proposal to recognize Spanish as its second language, and this got us to thinking about whether or not Spanish should be a second language in South Florida, where many people speak both. Now, this week, Doral leaders voted against the proposal to do that. It would have designated the city as multicultural, which is kind of ceremonial. And that aspect of the plan will be taken up by city commissioners. But they said no to this. But this was, they were promoting it to the mayor as a way to do business, to increase business to Latin America, Miami being the hub.
I think that the noteworthy part of it was that it was the residents who participated and went to the council meeting and say that they didn't want this, that they feel that it was not necessarily that necessary, that people already speak Spanish, and what they need, that this was going to generate some expenses for the city, and that this was what they needed was the government to do its work. And unfortunately, the mayor didn't have an answer to that. I mean, when people ask him, so...
Because it's a stunt, and it's nice to see the citizens call the mayor out for doing a stunt.
I know.
And to tell him to actually
and
do
you're right.
his job.
This was a stunt, but it did prompt us to ask folks in South Florida whether we should recognize Spanish as a second language. We asked you through the Public Insight Network, and we got a lot of responses via Twitter and via PIN. First, we're going to go to Caroline, who lives in Pinecrest. Caroline, welcome to you. Welcome to the Florida Roundup. So is it necessary to speak or understand Spanish in South Florida?
I really think it is. I think as a business owner or just a citizen here, you are at a disadvantage if you don't know Spanish. Just going to Publix, and regardless of what neighborhood you're in, you hear Spanish. You're missing the conversation, and I think you really miss out on opportunities. I speak Spanish, but English is my primary language.
Your family is from Cuba, right?
My parents, yes, my parents are Cuban. I'm first generation, although I was not born and raised in Miami. I was born and raised in New York, in Long Island, in a community where I was probably one of the very few Hispanics. You know, my dad worked on Wall Street. My mom was a preschool teacher, and English was just a part of our life, although we spoke Spanish often at home. It was expectation that I knew English as well. And I feel like here in Miami, like, we're really giving up on that, that it's okay to, you don't know Spanish, you don't know English, that's all right, you know? There's enough people here that let you sort of live and enjoy Miami as long as you know Spanish. And I think that's a shame, you know? I really think the importance of English has sort of gone out the window somewhat, not completely, and I'm sort of happy to see that in Doral, the citizens, you know, the people themselves, who often, most of them, probably speak Spanish at home, I think might agree with me.
Well, thanks very much for your call. Very well said, Caroline. Marcelo is in Coral Gables, who works in the advertising industry. So does your job require you speaking or understanding Spanish? Marcelo, welcome.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity. And yes, absolutely. Actually, my job has forced me to learn a bunch of languages. I speak English as a primary language, Spanish as a primary language. I speak Portuguese because I traveled to Brazil so much when we were purchasing ad agencies. And then when I became international, I decided I wanted to learn a bunch of languages. So I learned at least to say hi, how are you, and all of that in Mandarin, in Japanese. I speak a bit of French. I speak a bit of German. So, yeah. In my world, we cannot exist without having a bunch of languages.
But what if we're not as smart as you? We can't learn that many languages. I'm jealous of your brain.
I never thought about it in terms of my being smart or not. To me, language is something that I use to communicate and that I use to learn, and I don't take it as a religious pursuit. To me, you know, I try to make myself understood in the language that the person that I'm speaking to speaks. So I see it as me trying to be, you know, nice and effective, both at the same time, in trying to, you know, communicate. So it's, I don't see it as smart. I see it as, you know, committed to trying to get my point across.
And you did that, Marcelo, in many different languages, well, at least in English in this case. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much.
So, you, Mark, we mentioned you used to live in Tallahassee. I think you grew up in Key West. You live in Coral Gables now. You've seen this sort of disconnect statewide as far as whether you need to. I mean, obviously, it's different in different places.
Yeah, Miami-Dade is just a different state. It's a different state of mind, a different galaxy, a different world, a different planet. But for people who are worried that, oh, English is not going to really be learned, remember, like in Wisconsin, there used to be about 3 German language papers at the turn of the century, I guess in the 1900s, early 1900s. It just changes over time, and this is right. Just part of the vibrancy.
Second
of
and third generation are learning more English. Well, Rosemary, what about in Broward, the Sun Sentinel, Broward and Palm Beach?
Well, we have a Spanish language edition as well, El Sentinel. I would just add that good for Doral, because the move to have note a language as an official language or an official second language can only spur this English only. English is the official language. So good for them for not supporting this other move, because it's a slippery slope to resurrecting that whole debate about English only. And we don't need to go there. Let our communities decide for themselves how they want to communicate.
We're not going to have time to talk about this, but the Dolphin Stadium, the leaders of Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Jimenez, trying to put forth this referendum for people to vote on the public money for the stadium. We've discussed this on the show before. But you in Broward,
yes,
you totally support this.
Yes,
right?
We totally support it. That's right. We support it. We believe that. Well, okay, so you want to hear why quickly?
Very quickly.
Because of who would pay the tax. It would be people who are tourists coming to Miami-Dade. It would be people who buy products at the stadium. That would support the improvements that stadium needs.
But should they
needs.
Change the law so that Broward County could contribute, because they seem to be getting just the same benefits that Miami-Dade County would get from a stadium improvement?
I think the leadership of Broward County would support a change in law that did allow bed tax money to go to improve Sun Life, because this region is a region and we all benefit when these big events come to town. If we're going to give incentives to the gun manufacturers in this state, let's give them to fun family events that happen at the stadium.
And you can read more of Rosemary's opinions and her columns in the South Florida Sun Sentinel. She's the opinion page editor for that publication. Great to have you here. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Also our first timer, Teresa Frontado. You can read all about her work and social network with her at El Nuevo Herald. For Teresa, great to have you here for the first time as well.
Thank you, Phil.
And Mr. Mark Caputo. We haven't had you on in a while, and you were missing us.
You were dissing me, I think.
Good to have you back. That does it for the show today, Friday, February 15th, 2013. We do post it on our website at WLRN.org. We also rebroadcast on Saturday mornings at 6 a.m. We're produced by Alicia Zuckerman. Many thanks to our associate producer, Elaine Chen. Our Public Insight Network analyst, Steph Farrow, came up with some of our callers, and social media editor, Danny Rivero. Peter J. Meritz, Dan Gretsch, technical supervisor, Paul Leary. South Florida Arts Beat is next. It's only a game on Saturday. I'm Phil Latzman. Stay informed, South Florida.